Welcome to the Sagebrush Tray. Stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Mardell, reading Delilah of the Snows by Harold Bingham. Chapter 5. The New Country. It was a still evening, and Major Colthurst and Mrs. Esmond paced slowly side by side up and down the terrace at Holtker Grange. The house looked westward, and the last of the sunshine rested lovingly upon its weathered front, where steep tiled roof and flaking stone that had silvery veins in it were mellowed to pale, warm tints by age. Beyond it, orchard house, fernery, and vinery flashed amidst the trees, while the great cool lawn, shaven to the likeness of emerald velvet, glowing borders, and even the immaculate gravel that crunched beneath the major's feet, conveyed the same suggestion to him. It was evident that there was no need of economy at Holtker Grange, and Colthurst, who had faced the world long enough to recognize the disadvantages of an empty purse, sighed as he remembered the last budget the post had brought him. He had served his nation sturdily, according to his lights, which, however, were not especially brilliant, wherever work was hardest and worst paid, while now, when it was almost time to rest, he was going out again to the wilderness on the farthest confines of a new country, where even those who serve the government live primitively. He longed to stay in England and take his ease, but funds were even lower than they usually were with him. Still, he shrank from exposing his daughter to the discomforts he was at last commencing to find it hard to bear, and she had but to speak a word and remain, with all that any young woman could reasonably look for, the mistress of Holtker Grange. Though he roused himself with an effort, he felt that his conversation was even less brilliant than usual, and that his companion noticed it. It was certain that she smiled when she surprised him glancing somewhat anxiously across the lawn. "You have quite decided on going out?" she asked.
"I have," said Colthurst simply. "In 10 days from today, the commission's in my pocket. I was uncommonly glad to get it."
"Still," said Mrs. Esmond, "the pay cannot be very high, and it must be a wild country."
"It is quite sufficient for a lonely man, and now grace."
He stopped abruptly, a trifle flushed in face, and his companion smiled at him. "Yes," she said, "I understand. And if it happens as we both wish, I shall be content. Geoffrey has been a good son, but I could not expect to keep him always to myself, and I would rather it should be Grace than anyone else."
"Thank you," said Colthurst simply. "Whether I've done right in allowing her to come here, I do not know. In any case, I never suspected what might happen until a month ago. Then I was a trifle astonished, but the mischief was done."
Mrs. Esmond laughed.
"You might have expressed it more happily, though it is perhaps only natural that there was a day or two when I would not have found fault with you."
Colthurst said nothing further, but his thoughts were busy. He knew better than most men what life in the newer lands is, and he had no desire that Grace should share it with him. What she thought of Esmond, he did not know, but the latter had told him what he thought of her. And his mother was, it seemed, content with the choice he had made. A good deal depended on the girl's fancy. They had turned again when she came towards them across the lawn, as though she did not see them, until, hearing their footsteps, she stopped abruptly. Nobody spoke for a moment or two, but she felt their eyes upon her, and the crimson grew deeper in her cheeks as she turned to the elder lady.
"I see you know," she said with a little tremor in her voice.
You will forgive me if he feels hurt over it, but I felt I could not. Geoffrey, of course, is... The Major groaned inwardly when she stopped, and there was a sudden slight but perceptible change in his companion. Her face lost its usual gentleness and became for a moment not hard or vindictive, but impressively grave. I am glad, because he is my only son, that you had the courage to do the right thing. Now, she said. Grace flashed a swift glance at her, and the color showed a trifle more plainly in her face. But saying nothing, she hastily turned away. Colthurst stood stiffly still, evidently perplexed at something in the attitude of both, until Mrs. Esmond looked at him. I am disappointed, she said. Colthurst raised his hand in protest. It is very good of you to say so, but while she is my daughter, and I am naturally a trifle proud of her, the advantages would, in one sense, have been so much in her favor. I don't think you apprehend me. These affairs seldom fall out as one would wish them, which is perhaps now and then fortunate for all concerned. It is Grace I am disappointed with. Colthurst smiled somewhat grimly. I'm by no means sure that I do understand, but one thing at least is plain. She has made her own choice and must abide by it. It was 10 minutes later, and Mrs. Esmond had left him, when he came upon Grace sitting where a shrubbery swept round a bend of the lawn. She looked at him deprecatingly. I am very sorry, but it was out of the question. Quite, she said. Colthurst made a little gesture of resignation, for if he seldom foresaw a difficulty where others would have done so, he at least made no futile protest when it had to be faced. I suppose, he said, you realize what you have turned your back upon today? Still, I felt I had to do so. Colthurst checked a groan. Then, since you presumably know your own mind, there is nothing more to be said. You will be ready to come out to the northwest with me? Grace rose and slipped her hand through his arm. Father, she said, I'm sorry, dreadfully sorry. I must be a horrid responsibility. Colthurst smiled somewhat ruefully. So am I. No doubt we will worry along as we have already done, but it is a very hard country we are going to. It was scarcely a sufficient expression of what he felt. But Colthurst had his strong points, and his daughter knew it was very unlikely he would ever allude to the subject again. There were, however, as usual, guests at Holt Cargrain's just then, and they had formed a tolerably correct opinion as to what was happening. It was also natural that they should discuss it. And on that evening, two matrons and the lady who had taken Grace's part on a previous occasion expressed their views concerning the conduct of the latter. The girl led him on shamefully, said one of them. That was evident to everybody, and one would have fancied the reason was equally so, though of course we know now it wasn't the right one. Grace's advocate appeared reflective, and as it happened, her opinion was usually listened to. I've watched the girl, and she is interesting as a study, she said. I am, of course, not infallible, but it seems to me, from what I have heard of the Major, that she has inherited his disregard of consequences. Colthurst, one would conclude, is not a man who ever saved himself or others trouble by anticipating anything. One of her companions signified concurrence. And the fact that the opportunity for a flirtation with the most eligible man in the vicinity appealed to her natural arrogance accounts for the rest. Not exactly, though you are in a measure right. I should rather call it love of influence, for though I'm not sure Grace Colthurst realizes it, one could fancy that the opportunity for dominating a man of position or more especially character, would provide almost irresistible to her. Still, one must discriminate between that and the not unusual fondness for lovemaking. The distinction is a little difficult. It seems to lead to much the same thing. The previous speaker, who was a woman of discernment, shook her head. There is a difference, she said. The girl has, I think, a personality, by which I do not altogether mean physical attributes. That is apt to appeal to a man of character, though I almost fancy she will, sooner or later, be sorry she was ever imbued with it. There is a good deal that is admirable in Grace Coulthurst, but unfortunately, in one respect perhaps, not quite enough. It was not evident that the rest altogether understood her, but Mrs. Esmond appeared just then, and the subject was changed abruptly. In the meanwhile, there were at least three people who would have found no fault with Major Coulthurst's description of Western Canada, having discovered, somewhat to their astonishment, that the population of Quebec and Montreal was already quite sufficient, and that strangers without means were not greatly desired in either city. These three had, in accordance with Ingleby's previous purpose, started west again, and on the fifth day sat spiritlessly in a colonist car, as with the whistle screaming, the long train rolled into sight of a little desolate station on the Albertan prairie. All the way from Winnipeg, a dingy grayness had shrouded the apparently interminable levels, which lay parched and white beneath an almost intolerable heat, while the lurching car swung through a rolling cloud of dust that blurred the dreary prospect. Now, as they were slowing down, grimy faces were thrust from the windows, and perspiring men leaned out from the platforms, gazing down the track, and inquiring with expletives why they were stopping again. Hetty Ledger, however, sat languidly still, where the hot draft that blew in through an open window scattered the dust upon her. Her face was damp and unpleasantly gritty, for the water in the tank had long run out. Her head ached, as did every bone in her body, for colonist cars are not fitted as the Pullmans are, and she had, with indifferent success, for 4 nights essayed to sleep on a maple shelf, which pulled out from the roof above when one wanted it. She had certainly hired a mattress, but its 1 or 2 of thickness had scarcely disguised the hardness of the polished wood beneath it. And although the cost of it and the little green curtain had made a serious inroad on the few dollars left in her scanty purse, they had not solved the problem of dressing. While the atmosphere of a close-packed colonist car, when the big lamps are lighted in hot weather, is a thing to shudder at. It is also in view of the fact that most of the passengers dispense with curtains, somewhat embarrassing to rise in the morning and wait amidst a group of half-dressed men and women for a place in the cupboard at the rear of the car, where ablutions may at least be attempted, when there is any water in the tank. Presently, however, a big bell commenced to toll, and the jolting of the air brakes flung her forward in her seat, while in another few minutes the long car stopped, and the conductor pushed his way through the perspiring passengers who surged towards the vestibule. "They've had a big washout up on the track," he said. "You can light out and admire the scenery for 2 hours anyway, if you feel like it."
Eddie looked round, but could see nothing of her brother or Ingleby. She had seen very little to admire at other prairie stations, but anything seemed better than the close heat of the car. And when the vestibule was clear at last, she went out languidly and stepped down upon the track. Beside it rose 2 desolate frame houses, a crude structure of galvanized iron, and a towering water tank. But that was all.
and beyond them the gleaming rails ran straight to the rim of the empty wilderness. Nothing moved on its interminable levels. The dingy sky seemed suffused with heat, and along the track a smell that was stronger than the reek of creosote rose from the baked and fissured earth. The withered grass was of the same tint as the earth, save where the clay on the bank of a coulee showed a harsh red, and the vast stretch of dusty prairie seemed steeped in the one dreary gray. This, she reflected with a sinking heart, was the land of promise to which she had journeyed 5,000 miles to find a home. But though the track was suggestively littered with empty provision cans, there was as yet very little sign of the milk and honey. Hetty was usually sympathetic, but the sight of the frowsy passengers and unwashed children wandering aimlessly round the station aroused in her a curious impatience that was tinged with disgust. That hot afternoon, she wanted to be alone, and noticing an ugly trestle bridge a mile or so ahead, followed the rails until she came to it. A river swirled beneath it, but it too was utterly devoid of beauty, for the banks of it were crumbling, sun-baked clay, and it swept by a dingy, slaty green, thick with the mud brought down by the Rockies glaciers. However, it looked cool, and she climbed down until she found a place she could stand on and laved her arms and face in it. Then, as it happened, a piece of the crumbling clay broke away and 1 foot slipped in above the ankle, while the skirt of her thin dress trailed in the water, too. It was a trifling mishap, but Hetty was overwrought, and when she had climbed back and taken off and emptied the little shoe, she sat down on the dusty grass and sobbed bitterly. She felt insignificant and lonely in that great empty land, and its desolation crushed her spirits. She did not know how long she sat there, but at last there were footsteps behind her, and she colored a little and strove to draw the shoeless foot beneath the hem of the dripping skirt, when she saw Ingleby smiling down upon her. Then she remembered that the sleeves of the thin blouse were still rolled back, and the crimson grew plainer in her wet cheeks as with a little adroit movement she shook them down. Ingleby smiled again in a complacent brotherly fashion, which she found strangely exasperating just then, and sitting down beside her, took one of her hot hands. "Crying, Hetty, that will never do," he said. Hetty glanced at him covertly. His face was compassionate, but there was rather toleration than concern in it, and she pulled her hand away from him. "I wasn't, at least not exactly," she said. "And if I was, it was the weather, and why don't you go away?" Ingleby smiled again in a manner which, while kind enough, had yet a lack of comprehension in it that made her still angrier. "People don't generally cry about the weather," he said. "Well," said the girl sharply, "some of them say things they shouldn't. I heard you in a crowded car, too." She stopped abruptly as she remembered the scanty privacy of the colonist train, and that she was supposed to have been asleep about the time Ingleby had allowed his temper to get the better of him. He, however, only laughed. "Hetty," he said, "what's the matter? I always thought you brave, and I have almost a right to know." "I think you have," and there was a little flash in Hetty's eyes. "It was you who brought us here, and this is a horrible country. It frightens me." Ingleby was a trifle perplexed and showed it. He had known Hetty Leisure for 4 or 5 years, and had never seen her in a mood of the kind before. It also occurred to him, as it did every now and then, that although she was not to be compared with Miss Colthurst, Hetty was, in her own way, beautiful. Just then a pretty plump arm showed beneath the unfastened sleeve of the thin blouse, and the somewhat dusty hair with a tint of pale gold in it, lying low on the white forehead, matched the soft blue eyes, although there was a hint of more character than is usually associated with her type in Hetty's pink and white face. Ingleby noticed all this with impersonal appreciation, as something which did not greatly concern him. "Well," he said, "I'm sorry, and by no means sure I'm very much pleased with the country myself, but I don't quite see what else I could have done in the circumstances. Still, it hurts me to see you unhappy." Hetty turned to him impulsively. "Never mind me. I'm an ungrateful little beast. That's a fact, and you needn't try to say anything nice. I know I am. If it hadn't been for you, Tom would have been in prison now." Ingleby looked out across the endless dusty levels. "I'm sure the country must be a good deal better than it looks." "When one gets used to it," he said a trifle dubiously. "Anyway, we are 3-1 against it, and needn't be afraid of it while we stick together. That is the one thing we must make up our minds to do."
"There was a time when you didn't seem very sure you wanted Tom and me."
"Didn't you feel that I was right a little while ago?" Hetty said nothing for a space. She was quick-witted, and not infrequently understood her companion rather better than he understood himself. While recollecting the half-shy delicacy which occasionally characterized him, she felt a trifle comforted. It was not, she fancied, to please himself that he was willing to leave her behind, and she watched him covertly as he too sat silent, gazing at the prairie with thoughtful eyes. He was not, she was quite aware, as clever as her brother, and he certainly had his shortcomings, in fact, a good many of them. But for all that, there was something about him which, so far as she was concerned, set him apart from any other man. Exactly what it was, she persuaded herself that she did not know, or at least made a brave attempt to do so, for it was evident that he had only a frank, brotherly regard for her. Still, the silence was getting uncomfortable, and she flung a question at him. "How much have we left?" she asked. Ingleby laughed somewhat ruefully. $8, I believe. Still, we shall cross the Rockies tomorrow and start at once to heap up riches. We are certainly going to do it, as others have, and you will never be frightened any more." Hetty had a stout heart of her own, but nevertheless she was glad of the reassuring grasp he laid upon her shoulder. As she looked out across the muddy river and desolate gray-white plain, however, she smiled at him, and once more they sat silent, until a curious and unexpected thing happened. Far away on the rim of the prairie, there was a stirring of the haze, and a dim smear of pine woods grew out of the dingy vapor. Then a vista of rolling hills rose to view, and was lost in mist again, until high above them, all a great serrated rampart of never-melting snow gleamed ethereally against a strip of blue. It was a brief, bewildering vision, sudden as the shifting of a gorgeous transformation scene. And then the vapors rolled down again, but they felt that they had looked upon an unearthly glory. Hetty turned to her companion with a little gasp. "Oh," she said, "it was wonderful."
"It was real, at least," said Ingleby, "your first glimpse of the country to which I have brought you. I think we shall be happy there, and we will remember afterwards that we saw it together."
Again, the little pink tinge crept into Hetty's cheek, but she said nothing, and Ingleby's glance rested on the shoe which he had not noticed before.
"Hetty," he said severely, "do you want to catch cold? What is that doing there?"
Hetty essayed to draw her foot farther beneath the hem of the dusty skirt, and the color grew a trifle plainer in her face. But Ingleby made a little reproachful gesture, and taking up the shoe, rubbed it with his handkerchief.
"Now," he said, "I'm going to the bridge. Put it on."
He turned away, but the leather was stiff with water, and Hetty struggled fruitlessly with the buttons. And when she rejoined him, Ingleby noticed that she was walking somewhat awkwardly.
"Stand still a minute," he said. "You can't limp back along the track like that." He dropped on one knee, and Hetty turned her face aside when he looked up again. "It's such a pretty little foot," he said. Then they went back together and met Ledger on the trestle. He said nothing, but though he endeavored to hide it, there was concern in his sallow face. Join me next time on the Sagebrush Trail for more exciting Western adventure in Delilah of the Snows by Harold Binlaw.